Frightened fingers tremble as brittle pages turn. Fireside Mystery Theater presents The Midnight Reading, a special summer series of dramatic recitations of dark masterpieces in miniature by the masters of the macabre. Hello, I'm Ali Silva. Over 100 years before the Brothers Grimm, it was a French author named Charles Perrault who almost single-handedly established the groundwork for a literary genre known as the modern fairy tale. Perrault, much the same as the more famous German brothers who succeeded him, collected old folk tales and used them as the basis for his enchanted fables. In 1695, at the budding age of 69, Perrault published what was to become the most enduring work of his literary career, a volume called Tales and Stories of the Past with Morals, with the catchier subtitle Tales of Mother Goose. It was with this book that Perrault introduced to the world at large the wondrous flights of fancy on display in tales such as Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Puss in Boots, and Little Red Riding Hood. Considering the fact that stories such as these have been loved by children for generations, it can be something of a startling experience to read Perrault's versions today, which are often violent, cruel, and downright terrifying in contrast to the popular perceptions we have of these juvenile tales. All the best and most lasting children's stories have at least a few ounces of darkness tucked between their colorful pages. But perhaps no fairy tale is as ominous as the nightmarish Bluebeard, whose title character easily takes his place among literature's most abhorrent and depraved villains. Here to read Charles Perrault's Bluebeard is our own Mary Murphy.
There was once a man who had fine houses, both in town and country, a deal of silver and gold plate, embroidered furniture, and coaches gilded all over with gold. But this man was so unlucky as to have a blue beard, which made him so frightfully ugly that all the women and girls ran away from him. One of his neighbors, a lady of quality, had 2 daughters who were perfect beauties. He desired of her 1 of them in marriage, leaving to her choice which of the 2 she would bestow on him. Neither of them would have him, and they sent him backwards and forwards from 1 to the other, not being able to bear the thoughts of marrying a man who had a blue beard. Adding to their disgust and aversion was the fact that he had already been married to several wives, and nobody knew what had become of them. Bluebeard, to engage their affection, took them with their mother and 3 or 4 ladies of their acquaintance, with other young people of the neighborhood, to one of his country houses, where they stayed a whole week. The time was filled with parties, hunting, fishing, dancing, mirth, and feasting. Nobody went to bed, but all passed the night in rallying and joking with each other. In short, everything succeeded so well that the youngest daughter began to think that the man's beard was not so very blue after all, and that he was a mighty civil gentleman. As soon as they returned home, the marriage was concluded. About a month afterwards, Bluebeard told his wife that he was obliged to take a country journey for 6 weeks at least, about affairs of very great consequence. He desired her to divert herself in his absence, to send for her friends and acquaintances, to take them into the country if she pleased, and to make good cheer wherever she was.
"Here," said he, "are the keys to the 2 great wardrobes, wherein I have my best furniture. These are to my silver and gold plate, which is not every day in use. These open my strong boxes, which hold my money, both gold and silver. These my caskets of jewels, and this is the master key to all my apartments. But as for this little one here, it is the key to the closet at the end of the great hall on the ground floor. Open them all. Go into each and every one of them, except that little closet, which I forbid you, and forbid it in such a manner that, if you happen to open it, you may expect my just anger and resentment."
She promised to observe very exactly whatever he had ordered. Then he, after having embraced her, got into his coach and proceeded on his journey. Her neighbors and good friends did not wait to be sent for by the newly married lady. They were impatient to see all the rich furniture of her house, and had not dared to come while her husband was there, because of his blue beard, which frightened them. They ran through all the rooms, closets, and wardrobes, which were all so fine and rich that they seemed to surpass one another. After that, they went up into the two great rooms, which contained the best and richest furniture. They could not sufficiently admire the number and beauty of the tapestry, beds, couches, cabinets, stands, tables, and looking-glasses in which you might see yourself from head to foot, some of which were framed with glass, others with silver, plain and gilded, the finest and most magnificent that they had ever seen. They ceased not to extol and envy the happiness of their friend, who in the meantime in no way diverted herself in looking upon all these rich things, because of the impatience she had to go and open the closet on the ground floor. She was so much pressed by her curiosity that, without considering that it was very uncivil for her to leave her company, she went down a little back staircase, and with such excessive haste that she nearly fell and broke her neck. Having come to the closet door, she made a stop for some time, thinking about her husband's orders, and considering what unhappiness might attend her if she was disobedient. But the temptation was so strong that she could not overcome it. She then took the little key and opened it, trembling. At first she could not see anything plainly, because the windows were shut. After some moments, she began to perceive that the floor was all covered over with clotted blood, on which lay the bodies of several dead women ranged against the walls. These were all the wives whom Bloombeard had married and murdered, one after another. She thought she should have died for fear, and the key, which she pulled out of the lock, fell out of her hand. After having somewhat recovered her surprise, she picked up the key, locked the door, and went upstairs into her chamber to recover. But she could not, so much was she frightened. Having observed that the key to the closet was stained with blood, she tried two or three times to wipe it off, but the blood would not come out. In vain did she wash it, and even rub it with soap and sand. The blood still remained, for the key was magical, and she could never make it quite clean. When the blood was gone off from one side, it came again on the other. Bluebeard returned from his journey the same evening, saying that he had received letters upon the road informing him that the affair he went about had concluded to his advantage. His wife did all she could to convince him that she was extremely happy about his speedy return. The next morning he asked her for the keys, which she gave him, but with such a trembling hand that he easily guessed what had happened.
"What?" said he. "Is not the key of my closet among the rest?"
"I must," said she, "have left it upstairs upon the table."
"Fail not," said Bluebeard, "to bring it to me at once."
After several goings backwards and forwards, she was forced to bring him the key. Bluebeard, having very attentively considered it, said to his wife,
"Why is there blood on the key?"
"I do not know," cried the poor woman, paler than death.
You do not know, replied Bluebeard. I very well know. You went into the closet, did you not? Very well, madam. You shall go back and take your place among the ladies you saw there.
Upon this, she threw herself at her husband's feet and begged his pardon with all the signs of a true repentance, vowing that she would never more be disobedient. She would have melted a rock, so beautiful and sorrowful was she. But Bluebeard had a heart harder than any rock.
You must die, madam, said he, at once.
Since I must die, answered she, looking upon him with her eyes all bathed in tears, give me some little time to say my prayers.
I give you, replied Bluebeard, half a quarter of an hour, but not one moment more.
When she was alone, she called out to her sister and said to her, Sister Anne, for that was her name, go up, I beg you, to the top of the tower and look if my brothers are not coming. They promised me that they would come today, and if you see them, give them a sign to make haste. Her sister Anne went up to the top of the tower, and the poor afflicted wife cried out from time to time, Anne, Sister Anne, do you see anyone coming? And Sister Anne said, I see nothing but a cloud of dust in the sun and the green grass. In the meanwhile, Bluebeard, holding a great saber in his hand, cried out as loud as he could bawl to his wife,
Come down instantly, or I shall come up to you.
One moment longer, if you please, said his wife. And then she cried out very softly, Anne, Sister Anne, do you see anybody coming? And Sister Anne answered, I see nothing but a cloud of dust in the sun and the green grass.
Come down quickly, cried Bluebeard, or I will come up to you.
I am coming, answered his wife. And then she cried, Anne, Sister Anne, do you not see anyone coming? I see, replied Sister Anne, a great cloud of dust approaching us. Are they my brothers? Alas, no, my dear sister. I see a flock of sheep.
Will you not come down?
Cried Bluebeard. One moment longer, said the wife. And then she cried out, Anne, Sister Anne, do you see nobody coming? I see, said she, two horsemen, but they are still a great way off. God be praised, replied the wife joyfully. They are my brothers. I will make them a sign as well as I can for them to make haste. Then Bluebeard bawled out so loud that he made the whole house tremble. The distressed wife came down and threw herself at his feet, all in tears, with her hair about her shoulders.
This means nothing, said Bluebeard. You must die.
Then, taking hold of her hair with one hand and lifting up the sword with the other, he prepared to strike off her head. The poor lady, turning about to him and looking at him with dying eyes, desired him to afford her one little moment to recollect herself.
No, no, said he, commend yourself to God, and was just ready to strike.
At this very instant, there was such a loud knocking at the gate that Bluebeard made a sudden stop. The gate was opened, and two horsemen entered. Drawing their swords, they ran directly to Bluebeard. He knew them to be his wife's brothers, one a dragoon, the other a musketeer, so that he ran away immediately to save himself. But the two brothers pursued and overtook him before he could get to the steps of the porch. Then they ran their swords through his body and left him dead. The poor wife was almost as dead as her husband, and had not strength enough to rise and welcome her brothers. Bluebeard had no heirs, and so his wife became mistress of all his estate. She made use of one part of it to marry her sister Anne to a young gentleman who had loved her a long while, another part to buy captain's commissions for her brothers, and the rest to marry herself to a very worthy gentleman, who made her forget the ill time she had passed with Bluebeard.
That was Bluebeard by Charles Perrault and read for us by Mary Murphy. Now, it's no secret that nothing in the world of dark fiction is a fair match for the horrors found in real life. In order to drive that point home, we offer the following true account, which will reveal the probable source for Perrault's Bluebeard character. A person so vile, he makes the imaginary character seem like a wilting violet. Be warned. The following contains material and language that may not be appropriate for all listeners.
The Hero Who Died as a Fiend. Only, perhaps, in the works of the Marquis de Sade is there a more fantastic, paradoxical character than Gilles de Laval, Baron de Ray. Although his amazing career has provided countless authors with ample material for fictional treatment, de Ray himself was as real as the Brittany in which he lived and died. Born in the year 1404 into a rich, powerful family, Gilles was, after his father's death, brought up by his maternal grandfather, Jean de Cron. Even as a boy, he was a brilliant student in history and the arts. In time, he became an accomplished musician, dramatist, artist, illuminator, and bookbinder. From his beginning, a serene aristocratic future seemed assured. Yet, it is as a demon that his name lingers in history. When Gilles was 13, his grandfather arranged a marriage for him, but the young lady died. A second bride was selected the following year, but she too died, leaving Gilles totally unconcerned. Women were never to be among his many interests. A hardier young noblewoman, Catherine de Troyes, finally survived to become the Baroness de Ray, and through her fortune, to make Gilles one of the richest men in Europe. After a dazzling wedding, Gilles went through the formality of a honeymoon. Although the process obviously did not appeal to him, he succeeded in impregnating his wife, and thereafter paid no further attention to her, having thus assured himself of an heir. At this stage of his career, there was little to distinguish Gilles de Ray from any number of other French noblemen. Even his preference for members of his own sex was not altogether uncommon. Joining the army, he displayed immediate, outstanding military leadership. In 1426, he raised 7 companies of soldiers and plunged relentlessly into war against England. Now his star ascended rapidly. He came into favor with the Dauphin, later King Charles VIII. And when he was not battling the enemies of France, lived in lavish splendor more like a king or an emperor than a baron. He had a private retinue of 200 armed knights, maintained one of the finest libraries in France, and a number of impressive private chapels, castles, and chateaus. He staged extravagant theatrical productions. He supported artists, musicians, and sycophants. In short, he was the prototype of a grand seigneur, developing into an extraordinary epicure whose profligacy could only lead to disaster. Still, at 25, Gilles was appointed Marshal of France and was granted permission to wear the royal fleur-de-lis on the border of his shield, and then, shortly after his appointment, he attained his pinnacle of glory. He met Joan of Arc and was promptly smitten with religious fervor. He became thoroughly convinced that in the person of this simple girl lay the salvation of France. Joan, in turn, recognized Gilles as an exceptional soldier and requested that he become her personal protector on the battlefield. For a time, they fought the English side by side. But, on one fatal occasion, the king requested Gilles' presence elsewhere, and the Maid of Orléans was captured. Determined to rescue her, Gilles and his troops battered at the English for months without success. At Joan's martyrdom, Gilles was disconsolate. Abandoning his brilliant military career, he returned to his Brittany estates and plunged into the frenzied existence that led him to ruin, disgrace, and perpetual infamy. His extravagance grew boundless. He began selling properties to pay for the services of necromancers, sorcerers, magicians. His distraught wife left him in 1434, an event he hardly noticed. Dark rumors began circulating that the Seigneur was now an alchemist and a disciple of Satan, that he presided over black masses, orgies, and other debaucheries. It was whispered that a number of children who had disappeared, especially boys, had last been seen in the vicinity of his properties. Peasants passing by near dusk shuddered and crossed themselves. By 1436, Gilles' relatives obtained an order from King Charles VII to prohibit any further sales of the family property, a decree ignored by Duke Jean V of Brittany and his chancellor, the Bishop of Nantes, Jean de Malestroit, who kept buying up all available Duret property at favorable prices. Gilles himself was obsessed by his search for the legendary Philosopher's Stone, which would, according to popular belief, transmute base elements into gold. With it, he told himself, he could easily buy back everything he had sold. But at about this time, Gilles made a fatal misstep. He had sold one of his castles, Saint-Étienne de Malmont, to the treasurer of Brittany, Geoffrey Le Ferron. But when the treasurer's brother, Jean Le Ferron, came to take title, Gilles had him seized, imprisoned, and beaten. Jean Le Ferron was a priest. His maltreatment gave Bishop de Malestroit the excuse he needed to have Gilles arrested on an episcopal order. The bishop, who had been awaiting an opportunity to confiscate the Duret lands, brought forth on July 29, 1440, an indictment of 47 charges, including infringement of clerical immunity, sacrilege, heresy, the invocation of demons, sexual perversions, and murder. The trial of Gilles Duret, conducted jointly by ecclesiastical and secular authorities, was the most shocking of the 15th century and perhaps of all time. The testimony was bloody, grisly, and horrifying beyond belief. A typical charge was that Duret had, quote, taken innocent boys and girls and inhumanly butchered, killed, dismembered, burned, and otherwise tortured them, and that the said Gilles, accused, has immolated the bodies of the said innocents to devils, and has foully committed the sin of sodomy with young boys and in other ways lusted against nature after young girls, spurning the natural ways of copulation. End quote. Witnesses testified in minute detail as to the specific debaucheries alleged to have been committed by Gilles. They read like the case histories of Krafft Ebing. On October 21st, 1440, after torture or threat of it, accounts differ, Gilles Duret, voluntarily and freely, confessed to all 47 charges. He described how he had personally cut children's heads off and then committed further depravities. He finished by asking that the fathers and mothers of those so piteously slain pray for me. He also requested that the entire catalog of his crimes be publicly announced. The ecclesiastical and secular courts divided up the appropriate charges between them and found Gilles guilty on all counts after 40 days of trial. The secular court ordered that all Gilles' property be confiscated, then sentenced him to be strangled and burned with two of his accomplices. The sentence was carried out in Nantes on October 26, 1440. After prayers, final confession, and penitence, Gilles was granted absolution. At the head of a colorful procession, he marched humbly to the pyre. But instead of burning, his body was removed by special permission and buried in a neighboring Carmelite church. Although Gilles Duret is generally believed to have been guilty, an aura of irregularity still surrounds the circumstances of his arrest, trial, and conviction. Duke Jean and Bishop de Malestroit had too much to gain at Gilles' ruin to be impartial. At the trial itself, none of Gilles' 500 servants was called to testify. Witnesses who claimed to have seen him commit specific crimes did so only after being brutally tortured. Lastly, his chief collaborator in magic and alchemy, a Florentine necromancer, Father Francesco Prelati, was freed several months afterwards. Indeed, so suspect was the evidence against Gilles that a contemporary historian, Enguerrand de Monstrelet, said of the affair, "The greater part of Brittany's nobles, most especially those of his own kindred, were in the utmost grief and confusion at his disgraceful death." It is most ironic that the name of Gilles de Rais came in time to be connected with the legendary Bluebeard, who was supposed to have slain seven wives. The only wife he ever had left him long before his spectacular demise at the age of 36.
That was James Reeser reading the horrible account of The Hero Who Died as a Fiend by Bernhard J. Herwood from his book Strange Lives. It was published in 1966 by Popular Library Books. Copies of this book can be a bit hard to come by, but it is worth the search if true histories of the curious and the bizarre are up your alley. The Midnight Reading is produced by Gustavo Rodriguez and myself for Fireside Mystery Productions, with direction by Holly Payne Strange. Our audio engineers are Bill and Delaney Hafner. This series was recorded at the Silo Studios in Shirley, New York. It was written by Sylvan Sandovar. Our theme music is by Martina Da Silva. Don't miss upcoming installments of The Midnight Reading as well as recordings of our live show by subscribing to the Fireside Mystery Theater podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. A rating and review on iTunes would be most valued and appreciated. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @FiresideMystery. Pick up some Fireside Mystery Theater swag on our merch page at FiresideMysteryTheater.com. And for those of you in the New York City area, mark your calendars. Fireside Mystery Theater returns to the stage for a brand new season of thrilling and chilling original radio drama. On Sunday, October 1st, 2017 at 2 p.m., we shall be at the Bickford Theater at the Morris Museum in Morristown, New Jersey, for a show we call Sing the Old Alma Mater. Tickets on sale soon at morrismuseum.org. This is Ali Silva encouraging you to go out there and allow yourself to explore and discover the seductive allure of dark literature at your local bookstore or library. Thank you, kind listeners, for joining us. And until next time, be sure to mind the shadows.